Good morning. It is March 10th, and it is a Friday. Happy Friday from all of us here at KDNK Carbondale. This is KDNK News. Proposed cuts to Medicaid could impact nearly 130,000 seniors and people with disabilities in Colorado. Eric Gladys has more.
As the GOP-led Congress struggles to make good on promises to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, leaders of Colorado's community health centers say new bills introduced this week could be devastating, especially for centers in rural parts of the state already operating on slim margins. Scott Bookman with the Uncompahgre Medical Center on the Western Slope says rolling back Medicaid expansion would take away 30% of revenues they rely on to provide care to patients across the region.
The system out here works because we're able to provide care for everyone. And if the Medicaid expansion goes away, we see our margins disappear, and we're not able to keep the doors open, everybody loses.
The plan released by House Republicans Monday includes cuts to Medicaid and would phase out Medicaid expansion, which extended coverage to over 11 million low-income Americans. President Trump called the new plan wonderful and said future measures would make good on his promise of insurance for all Americans. Jennifer Morse with the Salute Family Health Centers, which serve nine communities in northeastern Colorado, says its uninsured rate dropped from 53% to 29% due to Medicaid expansion. She says over 500,000 children, 18,000 pregnant women, and some 130,000 seniors and people with disabilities in Colorado rely on the program.
3/4 of the Medicaid enrollees are actually working individuals. They either have an employer who does not provide health insurance, or even with subsidies, they still are not able to purchase insurance through the exchange.
Bookman notes extending Medicaid coverage to more Coloradans has also helped bring down costs because people are able to get preventative care at clinics instead of waiting until they're sick and turning up at the emergency room.
When people have access to quality primary care through a Medicaid expansion, then they get healthy and they stay healthy. And their cost to see the doctor is significantly less than a time-consuming and expensive trip to the ER.
On Wednesday, the American Medical Association urged lawmakers to withdraw proposals to overhaul Medicaid, saying the move could lead to fewer people with coverage and higher health care costs. This is Eric Gladys reporting for KDNK.
Today, tribal nations and indigenous communities are planning a march on Washington, D.C. and asking for allies across the country to take peaceful action at home. Local groups are planning a solidarity march from Pepke Park in Aspen to show support for the nationwide resistance camps and for the rights of indigenous people to defend the planet and water. The Aspen March starts at noon. Opioid abuse and addiction have a firm grip on rural communities in the West. For this edition of Sounds of the High Country, KDNK's Amy Haddon Marsh talks with High Country News Assistant Editor Paige Blankenbuehler about one Northwest Colorado town's struggle to gain the upper hand.
Paige Blankenbuehler, your article, When Private Pain Becomes a Community Problem, was published in the High Country News in late February, taking a look at opioid and heroin addiction in Craig, Colorado. One of the most compelling moments was the very end when the law enforcement officer is training his canine partner and things don't really go right. Can you talk about why you ended the story that way?
To me, that moment really exemplified what's going on in Craig right now in terms of how the community, the healthcare community, addicts and families of addicts, as well as law enforcement, are grappling to get their hands around this problem, and they really don't know how to do it. So in one of the final scenes of this story, it's a scene with Cortland Folks, who's a sergeant at Moffat County Sheriff's Office and the head of the K-9 unit. And since they've been seeing more drugs pouring into their community, they tooled up their K-9 unit, and he was training up one of his dogs named Kilo. And in this scene, he sets up the bins for the training material, and he takes this bean bag that has synthetic heroin on the inside, and he hides it in one of these bins. And Kilo can't find the synthetic heroin. He actually indicates a find on the wrong location. And this symbolizes, in a certain way, this whack-a-mole approach that law enforcement has had to take in the community, because it's a really complicated problem. First, they were grappling with methamphetamine. Then they were grappling with this huge explosion of painkillers in the community. And now the problem's shifting and morphing in really interesting ways, where they're seeing a multitude of narcotics coming into the community and they can't find the root of the problem.
Talk about the shift in heroin and opiate users and why this is happening.
My story goes deep into the history of this all the way to the 1990s when there was a paradigm shift in the treatment of pain. Pain was added as the fifth vital sign. Listeners are probably really familiar with this. If you go to a doctor and you're in pain, they ask you on a scale from 1 to 10, how extreme is your pain?
Mm-hmm.
So at that juncture in the late 1990s, when that was added to what patients were expecting from their doctors, it's a very subjective measure. Pain is different for every person, and there was an increased pressure on doctors to fix it. So what happened in the late 1990s through the 2000s is the pharmaceutical industry began responding to this need for prescription painkillers, and drugs like oxycodone, oxycontin flooded the market, and it outpaced our understanding of addiction and long-term use of these substances. Before all of this really exploded, opiate painkillers were reserved for really, really extreme cases of pain, like for cancer patients.
Right.
But this really all changed in the late 1990s and 2000s. So what's happened in the past decade is the prevalence of prescription painkillers is just through the roof. My story talks about this a lot throughout the West. Per 100 people in most states, the rate of opiate painkillers that are prescribed are 80 to 100 people have a prescription for an opiate painkiller. You can get them from the dentist, from your physical therapist, from your doctor. They're alarmingly easy to get.
You said that in the 90s, physicians were under pressure. Pressure from whom?
So there's just been a steady ratcheting up of, on the patient side, what they're expecting from their doctors, and then also from the American Pain Society in terms of giving your patients the best available tool out there to fix it. In my story specifically, one of my main characters, Dr. Joel Miller, opened up a private practice in Craig, Colorado, and the story goes into a lot of details about how that one private clinic really sparked this drug epidemic that Craig, Colorado is seeing currently. And there was a source who was a representative from the pharmaceutical industry based in Denver who really courted Dr. Miller and put pressure on him to be prescribing things like Schedule II narcotics like oxycodone and oxycontin to his patients.
You open the story with a heroin junkie who shoots up Adderall, surprisingly, which is an amphetamine, which you say he has a prescription for. He shoots it up right in front of you. What was that like for you to spend time with him and to watch him use drugs to shoot up?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really interesting moment. So to back up a little bit, we're talking about Josh Flaherty, who's prominent in my story. He's one of my main characters, and I met him in Craig, Colorado the second time that I went there on a reporting trip, and I was looking for someone who could really bring me closer to how a person becomes addicted to these substances. I met him at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and he said that he wanted to share his name. He wanted to be on the record and tell his story about his path on addiction because now he's ready to get clean. But this person, as you follow him through my story, you realize that he's really teetering on the edge of sobriety and an active addiction. When I met him the first time, he said he'd been clean, but only for about 30 hours. So he was really struggling. And the first time that I interviewed him, we decided that we would have breakfast together. So I went over to his home, and he made me breakfast, French toast and eggs and great black coffee, and we were just talking through his story. And as he's talking, he's describing all of the different medications that he's taking, and he says that the way he likes to take them is by slamming them, which means to shoot them up. And I just am asking him what that is like and why not just take it as a pill, why not swallow it? So he's describing this to me, and then says that he could show me. And obviously this is a really intense moment for me. I'd never seen anyone do that before. So as a journalist, you kind of walk through that with them and you're like, well, don't do this just because I'm here. And he told me that he would have done that anyway, and that's how he takes his Adderall every day. So he just allowed me to be a witness to that.
It just sounds to me like he hadn't been clean for very long. Talking about it could have put him right into a Jones.
That's really the main question that me and my editors had to grapple with throughout the entire reporting of this project. When you're writing about addiction and you're entering the lives of people who are in active addiction or are currently abusing their drugs of choice, they can't think as clearly about what the purpose of the story is. But we really felt that it was important to make sure that people have empathy for people like Josh. And there's no other way to do that unless he lets me in personally and tells his story and opens up to the public.
You profile an addict, a so-called pill mill, and law enforcement, along with providing statistics about the increase in opioid use, change in use patterns and demographics. With all of this, what would you say is most needed to help slow this so-called epidemic down?
There's a lot of political and bipartisan interest in solving this problem. And I do think it's going to take a lot of political will and federal funding to do that. At the same time, though, there's such stigma in these communities. And Craig is still trying to come to terms with the fact that it's going on. But I think the most important thing is that communities come out about the fact that they have a problem. My story goes into this a little bit, but in Craig, Colorado, they still don't have a detox facility for people to go through withdrawals safely.
Yes.
They don't have a rehabilitation center in town. So for someone who is addicted and wants to get clean, there are few options for them locally. So communities need to put money into bringing resources like that into their towns. The less access there is to those things, the more those problems are going to fester out of view, which makes them really, really difficult to deal with.
Thanks very much for talking with me today and for taking the time to investigate and write this fantastic story, When Private Pain Becomes a Community Problem.
Thank you for your interest, Amy.
You can find Paige Blankenbuehler's article, When Private Pain Becomes a Community Problem, at hcn.org.